Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the fourth weekend of August 2025. We are in the midst of some sunny weather, at least if the forecast holds, we're in the midst of it. It's been some sunny and warm conditions here in Sitka lately, and the forecast is calling for that to continue through much of this week. Definitely summer temperatures, and it's nice to see the sun, but I'm seeing signs of fall all around us. Birds moving south, the plants starting to die back, days getting shorter. We're less than a month away from the fall equinox, and I guess technically it's probably still late summer, but it's definitely feeling like early fall to me. It is a time of movement, changes, and lots of things happening. So if you're getting out, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a message there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded and originally aired back in October of 2024. I was speaking with Gavin McNichol, an assistant professor at the University of Illinois. He was in Sitka as a scientist in residence fellow at the Sitka Sound Science Center. During his time in Sitka last fall, he was doing some preliminary work in preparation for a multi-year project looking at some of the impacts of cedar decline, specifically on microclimate and carbon cycling in the soils. That project did get started this summer. I was able to meet up with a postdoctoral researcher and graduate students who are in Sitka to do some of the field work here. That will be continuing over the next 2 or 3 years, and I'll look forward to hopefully getting to speak with them and hear about some of the results as those begin to come in the future. For now, we'll join the conversation with Gavin, with him talking a little bit about his background.
I am a biogeochemist and a wetland biogeochemist kind of by training. That was what the focus of my PhD was. Which I think with biogeochemistry, you can kind of pull a little bit of, you know, the pure sciences, biology, physics, chemistry, and then the geosciences, kind of depending on what you want to work on. And so in wetlands, you know, we mostly think about the chemistry of wet conditions, so where oxygen is depleted, which does funky things for chemistry and for plant life and for microbial life, and maybe not so much... Certainly in the past, you know, past work, really looking at geology, except for maybe the way that it forms wetlands in the landscape within depressions and things like that. I want to get into that more. I'm actually, my current position, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and my department is the Earth and Environmental Science Department. After like doing my grad work and postdocs in ecology and environment programs and departments, and I've ended up in an Earth and Environmental Science department, which has like more of a hard earth sciences, geology, history, and connection. So I'm kind of excited to think about the geological part of the subsurface part of the ecosystem.
So we have no lack of water here, generally speaking. I definitely noticed that we have bogs and lakes and swampy areas, for lack of a better term. I don't really know like how those are understood from a sort of more formal scientific basis, like categorized, and like what is it that makes something a wetland as opposed to just something else? I mean, obviously we don't have desert here, so like those extremes are relatively easy, but in a location like Sitka where everything is wet for so much of the year, is it just all wetland? Or I know from a political standpoint it's important because like there's wetland, there's rules around that, and I guess that they have some things like that, and so there's probably political definitions of wetlands for that reason. But from your perspective as just somebody who's interested in studying them, learning more about them, you know, what sort of categories or distinctions do you like to make and feel are helpful?
How long do we have? No, I'm just kidding. I actually love that question. I remember posting on like Facebook when I was wrapping up my dissertation, being like, wow, okay. So my thesis after 6 years of grad school is like, what is a wetland? Is it just wetland? And then like, yes, period, kind of.
Yeah.
And so I think it is a potentially deep question. There are legal definitions of wetlands that can be as simple as like, I think the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has a definition that is impactful nationally for policy that's really just focused on the water table position. Like, are the soils wet for some period of the year? Is the water, groundwater, close to the surface or just above the surface? They talk about whether there's hydric soils, which means that the soil actually has a signature of that wetness that's left on the soil. So the I don't know if people have been up and into the forest soils here, but you can see this like sometimes bright orange oxidized iron rich soil, and then sometimes you'll see this like gray modeling within that. That gray is reduced iron, and it's one of the indicators that they'll use to determine if it's a hydric soil. So there's sort of the water table. Is it wet? Is there a sign of hydric soils? And then are the plants that they identify adapted to wet conditions? And so that's not the simplest definition. That could just be a water table definition. Some hydrologists will just be like, is the water table close to the surface? Yes. All right. It's a wetland. Then the U.S. Army Corps, a little bit more than that. You've got the soils and plants. But really I think, it does just start with that hydrological definition, and it can, from that, so many different things can arise. Like, you know, you asked, is Southeast like one giant wetland? And I think the most obvious wetlands that people are most familiar with are the muskegs here, right? And the bogs or the fens. I think that's how they'd fall out in the kind of conventional wetland classification. But the upland soils do show a lot of that. Like, you'll see that bright orange iron-rich clays next to the gray reduced iron, showing that in this case, that, you know, iron's being reduced, and it's a sign that there's a lack of oxygen in the soil. So that's normally what we use to diagnose a wetland soil, and that's, you see that outside of the muskegs. I mean, the muskegs don't have mineral material below them, so I think there's already like clues that if you're thinking about the function, maybe thinking about microbial processes or these hydric-like indicators, that you see that pretty widely across Southeast. So maybe there's okay. You could make a case that it's in some ways behaving like a wetland, even though it's even outside the muskegs.
Yeah, I think about some of these steep forested slopes that we have here in Stargavin Valley in particular is one, a valley. We had a large landslide happen there in 2014 and came down one side of the valley down to the stream and then just like blew down the stream. But on the uphill side of the opposite side of the valley from where it came, it cut, you know, there was a trim line where that came down and it just cleared everything out. And so that was some level above the stream course, but not very far above. But one of the things that I noticed there that I was interested in is each time that I went up there, there was this seep of water I mean, it was just like this, I guess it would be laminal flow, you know, this flow of water that seemed to be constant along that slope. And because it had been cut, you know, it was just like, I think before that would have all been covered in soil and vegetation. I wouldn't have seen it. It was just coming straight into the creek, and I wouldn't have noticed. But because all that had been cleared off as part of this landslide and then just like completely cleared off, so it was just bare rock, I could see that just like flowing out. And it hadn't necessarily rained like really recently. And so I don't know how long it did raise questions for me. It's like, how long does it take for that water, like how long will that water be flowing down the mountain? Like if we had a 2-week dry spell, would that be enough for it to all, I'm sure that the volume would be decreased, but would it go to zero? Or would there always be some water just flowing down that steep slope? And it was, you know, it wasn't in a channel. It was just kind of just seemed like it was just part of the slope. And, you know, going uphill, I wouldn't know that it was there because again, it's running underneath the surface. I don't know how that impacts, you know, when I think of wetlands here, I don't think of water as moving so much, but I guess maybe if I remember correctly, fens tend to have water moving through them more. Mm-hmm. And so you don't, and bogs tend to have water be much less flowing through. And, you know, from a vegetation standpoint, you know, we're looking at sphagnum dominated versus sedge dominated or other kind of herbaceous things, maybe as the fens and sphagnum in the bogs. But, at least that's what I've, you know, picked up over the years from talking to people who are more into this than me. But then these forested slopes like have constant water flow, but it's forest, you know, or near constant water flow, you know. And so, yeah, just it makes me wonder. I don't know like what processes and if the fact that if that's, you know, frequently being regenerated, if like there's enough, maybe it's not oxygen depleted at that point because there's oxygen, dissolved oxygen in the rainwater. I don't know. So does that kind of create a different, I could imagine that that creates a different sort of biochemical system than a, like a traditional wetland kind of bog fen sort of system.
Yeah, definitely. I think the through flow of water, it's a defining characteristic here. We have a lot of rain and then, steep slopes. And, in terms of organizing our understanding of wetlands on the landscape, there is some really great work by Dave Damore at the Forest Service in Juneau, Forest Field Station in Juneau. And he and some of his colleagues kind of organized the landscape into three, they call it hydropedological units. So I guess this field really applies in places where you can, where the intersection of hydrology and soil science, or there's a really important role for hydrology in the formation of soils. And so the patterns you see in the landscape of in soils can be explained by kind of differences in that hydrology. So the three units, they, have you heard of this scheme before?
No, well, maybe, but not that I remember off the top of my head. Yeah.
Yeah, there's three organizing units that they think about. The upland forest soils, which are well-drained typically, but still pretty wet, and there's a lot of through flow of water, but it's just not maybe accumulating as much in those layers. And those are sort of the places where you get sort of the classic, like spodosol, it's called, where you would see maybe some organic material at the surface, like a kind of a duff material layer on the surface. But then below that, you would actually reach mineral soil, and that's where you might see the reduced and oxidized iron, but it's still relatively well drained. And then on the other end of the spectrum, on the flat areas of the landscape, you have the muskeg, which you can pick out so easily, right? Because it's the wetland is visible from the surface. But then in the middle, they have this wetland, sloping wetland forest unit that, in ecosystem science, we sometimes use the word ecotone for a transition between ecosystems. I don't know if this is considered an ecotone, but it is a sort of transitional part of the landscape where it's not as steep as the upland forests, where you see like the really dense canopies of trees, and then it's not as open as the muskeg, but it's wet enough that you have, you can have like peat deposits or like large growth of like maybe some moss derived organic matter, like deeper than in the upland forest. And then maybe the soil chemistry starts to look a bit more like a wetland, but it's still sloping. And that's the part that I think really is really distinctive about this temperate rainforest environment, is that unless you have flat, if you have sloping land in other places that are less wet, the soils are almost certainly going to be too well drained to be considered wetlands. They're going to be upland soils, but here it's so wet that even on those shallow slopes you get that. So that's when I was working on a soil carbon map, this is like 6 years ago, 2018 in Juneau, I remember reading those papers and trying to understand the patterns of soils on the landscape. And to the best of my knowledge, that's like the way that the soil scientists think about the patterns here. I think I'm not really strictly a pedologist. I am a biogeochemist. And so I feel like it's always in my best interest to really talk to the botanists and the natural history experts and the pedologists and so on to learn the details of the system that I'm studying. But I guess I feel like as a biogeochemist, I might be more likely to say, yeah, actually there's wetland-like behavior everywhere, even though, anywhere that we're seeing like a reduction of iron in the soils, for example, turning the iron like from orange to gray. I think as a biogeochemist, we have a different, slightly different perspective that maybe we relax a little bit on the definitions, kind of natural history, categories and even less some of the pathology, but we focus more on the processes. And so we call it anaerobic processes that we normally associate with wetland soils. If they're happening in large amounts outside of traditional wetlands, then I'm inclined to be like, yeah, they're behaving like wetlands, even if they're not. Wetlands.
Yeah. So from your perspective, you know, it's the chemistry that's happening is what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. How wet is it? I mean, it is kind of interesting as you're describing the kind of three different classifications as sort of reflecting on my experience wandering around in the woods here and on slopes. And there are definitely slopes, well, even valleys where it's not very wet, and slopes where it is pretty wet. So valley bottoms that are relatively flat, but not very wet. But I think they're filled with rock, like not bedrock, but like, alluvial, colluvial kind of material that's very porous, I guess, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. And so I think of one valley in particular here where the river is, except in the highest flows, the river channel is dry. But it's a pretty good-sized river channel, so it clearly gets water flow at times during higher water. And downstream, it's coming out. You know, and so there's plenty of water moving through, but it's moving through underground and probably deep enough underground that it's not right at the surface. And then there are slopes where I wonder if what's going on in places is just like the bedrock is so close, there's very little permeability for the water to go. And so it's just right near the surface and it allows these plants, mosses and sphagnums and things that like to hold on to the water. And so it kind of is able to build up a bit of that sort of organic sponge there, which is, you know, I don't see extent. I mean, I can think of places where there's more of it and places of it where I don't run into that. But definitely, you know, it's if I'm thinking about walking up the hill, it's slipperier. And, you know, it tends to be like, you know, you can slide more easily and not necessarily what you want to do on some of that kind of terrain because it can be quite steep. But it's still holding that in that. And the trees don't tend to be as large. In those places is, you know, the big spruces seem to like the better drained stuff. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. And now it makes me, I mean, I'm probably not going to carry a shovel around, but I suppose that's what, you know, a committed soil scientist person would do is carry a shovel around.
You can wait for, like something to happen that exposes the soils,
yeah,
you know,
or tree falling over or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe I'll learn something about. Yeah, because I would be curious. Sometimes I see stuff and I'm like, what do these different colors mean and why is it doing that? But it sounds like some of it might be this reduced iron thing that the gray stuff. And
Yeah. We actually, it was one of the things we were talking about with the Sitka High students this week was, you know, we were measuring, we were collecting samples of soil and surface waters just around Sitka High and measuring how much dissolved oxygen was in those samples. And in a few cases, we saw like oxygen had come all the way down, depleted all the way down to zero. And, you know, obviously we're talking a bit about the fact that would be like fatal for us or fatal for fish. But that for microbes, it's not necessarily fatal and that other microbes can kick in that can breathe on, you know, respire and other things. And so, yeah, we talked about iron. That's why we were measuring iron as well and seeing where we saw like a signature of iron being respired on by microbes. But yeah, exactly. Like the nice thing about the iron is that there is this really clear color change. So you can, it's changing from rust color to like kind of this grayish, gray look. And, so it's something you can just see as you're walking through the, you know, through the forest as a naturalist. But yeah, I think the awesome thing for me about being in Southeast and in Sitka is just the intactness of all of those conditions. And it just means like, I feel like every time you go, I haven't had a ton of hikes. Maybe it wears off over decades or something, but for me it seems like every time you go out you see something new because there's like all of the different possible combinations of like geology and climate and the way the topography, the way the mountain, which side of the mountain you're on, and the time of year, there's sort of like almost an infinite variety of conditions. And then I think if you're interested in the plant life or the or even the animal life, but in the plant life or the bryophytes, the mosses and lichens and liverworts, like it's amazing how well adapted they are to those particular conditions. And so it's like I think I've experienced this excitement for Southeast in part that's brought me back again and again, because it's not like that everywhere, right? I grew up in Scotland, where it used to be a rainforest environment a long time ago, before the written record, before most people can conceive of kind of even picture an ecosystem. Once you take away the vegetation, or you disturb the vegetation, the natural vegetation enough, you lose like one of the big indicators for what that environment actually is. Like, you lose the patterns that you might otherwise see between wetlands and uplands. It just looks like flat land, with maybe pooling water somewhere.
Yeah.
But I think that's why maybe being in Southeast gets me more excited about the plant ecology and the trees and the bryophytes, because they're here. It sounds obvious, right? But it wasn't on my radar as much before.
Well, it is interesting. So much, I mean, Southeast Alaska by global rainforest standards isn't especially diverse. You know, you think of tropical rainforests and there's hundreds of species of trees. You know, we have 5 or 6. And so it's relatively easy. It's relatively tractable. And most of the area has most of the same species. And one of the things that's interesting to me as somebody who likes to find new things is looking for those pockets that are different for one reason or another. And so, you know, vast majority of land, of forested land especially, is going to have the same trees, the same herbaceous plants, understory shrubs, and the same mosses and liverworts. Generally, you'll find, you know, everywhere, not literally everywhere, but pretty regularly. There are, I'm fascinated by the differences. Like if I go out to here in Sitka, Mosquito Cove is one trail, there's a loop there. Or if I go up Indian River, they're both forest. They both look like forest. They both look like, you know, Southeast Alaska forest, but there's something that just feels different about them, right? And I'm not sure quite what that is. Maybe part of it's the lighting and, you know, just the terrain around it that gives that feel. But there also just feels like, and I've been curious, if I could be somehow just deposited into a forest that I was familiar with, just based on the feel of it, could I tell which valley I was in, for example, just because of some of the subtle differences? Like most of it's the same, but there are these subtle differences in relative abundances or something. I don't know. So I've been curious about that. But then there's also the pockets. You know, maybe there's an outcrop of here in Sitka area, we have very little carbonate rocks. So it's we just don't have calcareous loving species. You know, we don't have limestone here. Like I know of one or two marble outcrops that are small. And I found some mosses on those that I wouldn't expect to find elsewhere. I mean, that's what they like. They like these kind of basic things. But generally speaking here, it's all acidic kind of geology. And so we don't have those carbonates here. So if you can find a little pocket where there's a different geology, then you can find these different species sometimes. Or maybe it's, you know, has something to do with just a little microclimate, or I don't even know what it all is. And sometimes it's the trees, like some trees, cedar trees will have different epiphytes than some of the other ones in terms of mosses and liverworts. So there are things like that that are just, they're interesting to me. And part of what keeps me going out is looking for these little nooks and crannies that are just like, you know, this little pocket in this otherwise, you know, looks largely the same. And I'm not really finding anything different species wise. But then in this little, you know, maybe it's a little cascading waterfall that just is constantly wet. And sometimes it's just that, you know, some species are just sparse, and I don't know that they need something special exactly, but they just don't seem to show up very often. And every once in a while you'll find one of those for whatever reason. But, you know, those sort of, I guess it's a little bit Easter egg hunt, like, you know, it's like, what can we find out there? And you never know. Yeah. I mean, I've been getting around for a long time. You know, since I grew up here, I wasn't really looking in the same way when I was younger, but, you know, starting maybe a little over 25 years ago when I started to pay more attention to natural history stuff and species and trying to document them. I continue to find things Even just this fall, I was a place on Kruzoff Island that I hadn't spent much time before. It was just a beach, but it was a different beach and had species there that I hadn't seen before. And, you know, it wasn't that different, but it was different enough. And so I'm curious, like, okay, what are the differences here? Why is why is it this way? And then that particular place, I think it just had a flat part that was just the right level of tide. It was low enough that it wasn't going to get forested, but high enough that it rarely got covered by, rarely got flooded, probably only in the highest tides of fall and winter. And so that supported a different kind of vegetation than I see elsewhere. Because most of our beaches are pretty steep, or, you know, they're a little lower down or a little higher up, and you get differences there. So it's just kind of fascinating to see. But so you were talking about the anaerobic things. Is that part of what you're interested in looking at particularly, is the anaerobic microbes that are in the wetlands?
It definitely was for my graduate work on wetlands. My grad work was taking place at a time when California wanted to look into wetland restoration as a way to mitigate climate change. So this idea of kind of carbon farming was a thing. So it was in an area that kind of maybe made some amount of sense, because it was the Sacramento Delta, Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and so it's these islands that were reclaimed from formerly tidal wetlands and then sort of diked and turned into farming land, which is incredibly productive. But the soils had kind of subsided just because they lost water and dried out, but also subsided because microbes are chewing on the organic matter over like 100 years. So now the modern-day delta is like these kind of bowl-shaped islands, and so so the sort of policy and management environment for my thesis was like these, can we win on multiple fronts? Can we find a win-win if we reflood parts of these islands, restore wetlands, kind of safe, shore up the levee system, and capture carbon out of the atmosphere at the same time? That was kind of, that's continued on, you know, over the last like decade, with larger parts of the Delta area being restored. And the part that I really wanted to understand was, I guess one question was, why, when we go from a drained to a reflooded condition, do we see this change in what we call the carbon balance, you know, whether the ecosystem is losing or gaining carbon? And particularly the soils. And then the anaerobic part does factor into that. So when we flood soils and we lose oxygen from the soil, you know, we discussed this also at Sigahai this week, was that, you know, we have an abundance of oxygen in the atmosphere, but it's pretty sparingly soluble in water. And so microbes can quickly deplete the oxygen that's there. That's one way that you slow down decomposition, and it's one part of this carbon balance. The other thing that I think has kind of taken off and I've run with more in the last few years is that under particularly anaerobic conditions, when you have oxygen limitation for a long time, you eventually run out of everything, including iron and these other sources for microbial respiration, and you can start to produce methane. And that, of course, is another greenhouse gas. And so you add another, you know, character to the story of about greenhouse gases in wetlands. And the anaerobic we call it anaerobic metabolism for microbes, or anaerobic biogeochemistry in wetlands, that has been something I've been interested in for a really long time. And I kind of stepped away from it for a while. To work on some other projects but so since I got my faculty job 3 years ago, I have looked for ways to bring some of that wetland or anaerobic biogeochemistry and perspective to what I hope to do in Southeast. So we have submitted, you know, applications for federal funding to work on methane in the temperate rainforest. And because it's so wet, there is a potential that these musk eggs and, you know, forested wetlands that we talked about could be generating methane, but there's not really any data on that. And there's also reasons why they might not be, because it depends. There's sort of a oxygen supply story, but there's also a carbon supply story. And so if there's not a lot of the right type of organic matter, then you won't get methane. So that's one thread of research that I would like to continue, but I wasn't successful with getting, you know, the last round of funding to work on that. But I have been maintaining ties with Jason Feldman, Aaron Hood, Alison Bidlack, and Dave Damore. I hope I'm not forgetting anyone, but based over in Juneau, and still hoping that we can study that in the long run. But then sort of this other opportunity came up to work on yellow cedar, and actually, even though I don't have a natural history, I don't have a plant ecology background, we actually did get funded for that. So now I'm kind of scrambling to learn as much as I can about the tree, and that's partly why I'm here in Sitka, is to learn. I know that the community in Sitka is deeply knowledgeable about the tree, and it's a great place to have as a home base to study the stands, both living and some that are in decline. So sorry, I'm kind of rambling now, but I think that the anaerobic part is still, I guess it's sort of peripherally there with the yellow cedar story, because they, and this is a question I actually had for you, was my understanding is that yellow cedar can sometimes occupy the periphery of wetlands, and they have shallow roots that can help them survive those wet areas. But we were also earlier discussing a little bit about yellow cedar on steep hill slopes, and so that's something that I'd be interested to hear what you think about, whether yellow cedar are predominantly these wetland periphery species, or whether they're occurring up on the slopes too. But that's the only really connection to anaerobic now. It's really, I have to shift gears and think about trees in a big way.
Well, from some of the smallest organisms to some of the largest, I suppose. not so much change there. Yeah, it is interesting. I suppose the anaerobic stuff, it's complications there. But in terms of the cedar, it definitely, I think it's one of those things where, because the spruce and hemlock don't do so well in the wetlands and the cedar can do okay, you'll often find cedar, it's interesting. Over on Khrushchev Island in the bogs there, I often see it as these shrubs. It doesn't grow very tall, or maybe you'll have one thing, but there'll be a bunch of shrubs. And if I remember correctly, one of the speculations about why that didn't seem to be declining was that the shrubs were basically providing protection, insulation, because the shrubby growth essentially was providing an insulation from those roots to keep them from experiencing those. The post dormancy break freezes was what was damaging the roots and then ultimately causing the that was the precipitating factor that led to this cascade of ultimately the trees dying. And so maybe one of the reasons that you don't see that in the musk eggs over there so much, you see it along the fringes. So there's plenty of cedar decline on Khrushchev, but there's plenty of these short cedars that, just waist high shrubby stuff. In the forest, in the bigger forest, it depends on the forest, but I see cedars around Sitka, at least throughout the forest. Some places they're actually a significant percentage. Sometimes they're more scattered out, more on the slopes than in the valley bottoms. I don't really see them in the valley bottoms, except for, in marginal conditions, kind of what I might call low productivity scrub forest kind of stuff, where it'd be kind of transition. It doesn't always literally a transition between a bog and a forested area, because sometimes there's not a bog in the middle, but it's kind of this area that's wetter, low productivity. And so it's tends to be open canopy, and I think the cedars are just slower growing than the spruces and hemlocks. I suspect they would be more susceptible to decline in those kind of places, but I haven't really looked specifically. On slopes where I'm thinking about where I wander around, which aren't going to tend to be as wet, because I don't like going through that scrubby stuff. It's shrubby, and it's annoying to walk through. So if I can avoid it, I'll tend to avoid it. But there is plenty of cedar growing on these slope stands. And I remember, I think maybe you worked with Brian Buma when you were in Juneau some. Yeah, so I talked with him a couple of times. I don't know if it was the last time he was in town, but one of the times he was in town, we went up Gavin Hill Trail here, and because he was curious. He's like, well, we don't really see any young cedars. Like, we see the seedlings and we see the big trees, but like, where are the teenagers? You know, that kind of a thing. I don't remember what the cedar equivalent would be. And so I was kind of curious about, and since then I've started paying attention more to that particular thing. And I've noticed plenty of like smaller cedars, but cedars are long-lived trees. So at some level, you know, just from a population demographics sort of standpoint, I wouldn't expect to see a lot of kind of young ones. You're mostly going to see mature ones or seedlings, and, you know, because there's a high rate of death among, you know, the seedlings. Like there's with, you know, most animals, you know, you are unlikely to make it past your first year or two, but then after that, you know, you survive to adulthood and you'll probably survive for a few years. So, you know, I think about for folks in Sitka that are used to looking at seagulls, you know, the adult gulls, like a lot of them are, you see a lot of adult gulls and you see a lot of first year gulls. Well, because if a gull lives 20 years, 15, 16 of those years are in adult plumage. One of their first year, there's bunches of them, but a lot of those aren't going to survive the first year. And so that second and third year, those cohorts tend to be smaller, and then they transition into adult and they just join the big crowd, you know. And so I suspect it's something similar with trees. But there are cedars of varying ages that I've noticed along these slopes. And I think they take advantage of gaps when trees blow down or something. They get a chance to grow up, and they can grow fast enough. Maybe they like slightly wetter soils up there. I don't know, but there's places where it doesn't seem squishy, you know, by Southeast Alaska standards anyway.
So just so I understand, the kind of it sounds like there's sort of an observation probability thing going on there, where like, I know you have a background in statistics.
Yeah.
And you did your grad work in statistics?
I did some in, yeah, math and statistics, yeah.
Yeah, because I feel like that, I think you were saying something about that. There's, if you only have some portion of the, like, saplings actually surviving to adulthood, and also you have a tree that's potentially hundreds of years old, this, yeah, the probability of running into one that's between that, like,
yeah,
10 to 50 year old.
Right. If it lasts for 40 years of that sapling stage, you know, what are the chances that you, like, it's got to be a small proportion of the population, or you wouldn't have these old trees, unless there's some other bottleneck in their age, essentially. So if they're all dying at 100 and you only get a few after that, you know, then there could be, but there's no reason that I'm aware of to think that that's going on, right? So once they get big, they tend to just keep growing. They're,
yeah,
remarkably long-lived trees, unless something like the cedar decline comes along.
Right, and the decline is not tied to a particular age.
Yeah. Doesn't seem to be.
Yeah,
as best I understand it. So yeah, there's just not that many. You wouldn't expect to see that many of that sapling age class relative to overall, you know.
I was thinking a bit about that. Yeah, I think one thing I've also become more interested in, I'm now at this Earth and Environmental Science Department, when previously I've been in ecology and environment programs, and so I have an incentive, and I'm also just genuinely making connections to Earth history and thinking into deeper time. And I think as a biogeochemist right now, a lot of us are, for the most part, thinking about contemporary problems, like really contemporary, like, you know, climate change now, a few decades into the past, maybe a century into the future, which, you know, if you contrast that with geology, it's like it's a cliche to make the contrast. It's that, you know, a hair breadth against like miles of history or something like that, or a meter of history. I'm not sure exactly, but yeah, I have both an incentive and also just genuinely curious about expanding kind of the scope and time for the places that I'm studying. And that's both true of where I grew up in Scotland. I'm hoping to work there in the future, looking at like the history and a potential future for the rainforest there. But I also just think it's interesting that in Southeast you have a tree species that it's old enough that only a few, I don't know if you can think about it in terms of generations, but only a few generations of yellow cedar takes you back quite a long way.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm also not an evolutionary biologist, but like there's something there in the way that the responsiveness of a species to change must be kind of shaped by its how long it can live. And yeah, I just think there's I feel like most of our, it's probably fair to say that most of our knowledge in Western science about ecosystems is still very biased towards the present.
Yeah.
Right. And so like I think there's potentially really interesting stories about that like century to millennium timescale. And it's one reason why I really did want to start with, I have this privileged opportunity to be based out of the Science Center, who can help, has been helping connect me with both schools and educators, but also the community and including the Alaska Native and Tlingit, the Sitka tribe. I hope to join the Keaani Commission, the kind of plant-focused commission of the Sitka tribe at their next meeting. And I think that I think expanding that like period of time beyond just like a generation or two of human lifespans, like it could be, I don't know, I think it could like bring in a lot of additional perspective and also just like some really different perspectives on this, just the science questions, even just the deeper history of Southeast is something that I'm interested in talking about too.
The conversation I had with Brian Boomer last time, he was saying, that was part of what he was looking at was landslides and these, what are the effects on these long-term carbon sinks or sources?
I think with the Yellow Cedar Project, we really want to look at a range of stand conditions now. So live stand versus, relatively recent decay, say, and then in detail try to characterize the... We call it the climate interactions, but when we say that, we mean primarily the local micrometeorology. So, if you have an intact canopy versus an open canopy with snags, you're going to have different amounts of light penetration that could either heat or not the soil surface directly. You'll have more or less, perhaps, water transpiration through the trees. If there's no longer any green foliage on the tree, you might lose a source of local water to the atmosphere. So there's these sort of local meteorological interactions that if you scale those processes to like a stand to landscape or even to the region, like maybe it starts to add up to actually a kind of meaningful climate interaction, long-term weather change. And then the other piece is the carbon cycle that you just talked about, like as we lose yellow cedar to decline, is the ecosystem losing carbon? Do we see a shift towards wetland conditions in those wetland periphery areas already? Or maybe we see, I think there's some evidence for this regeneration of other, maybe a different tree species composition coming in with the hemlock or spruce or pine. Lauren Oakes's studies and kind of work ended with some publications on that, and where it was indication that there would be regeneration in some places, right? And so sort of like a hopeful end to that. But I don't think I think it's fair to say they didn't address that kind of in any conclusive way. And so we also won't get to a definitive answer in our study, because we're not going to go to the many, many sites that you need to go to answer that question. But we will. We do want to try to really well characterize the local micrometeorological feedbacks between the decline and the atmosphere that might lead to a more or less favorable condition for plants or more or less favorable condition for wetlands establishing themselves. So, I think the project will touch on ideas around succession and carbon and wetland extent. And actually, as an aside, there's a little bit I want to just mention about when I first came to Southeast Alaska. I was working with Brian on this soil map, and we wanted to understand how soil organic carbon was distributed in Southeast. And so it seemed like, you know, there's a real big difference between the muskegs and the uplands, right? So it might be good to start with that. That in some cases the muskegs are like 3 to 5 meters deep, and a lot of it's all just like accumulated plant material. So it's a huge, potentially huge carbon reservoir. So when I was looking into that question, I ended up coming across some papers that talked about this process of pollutification. I don't know if you've heard that term, but
this is turning to wetlands, basically.
Yeah. And it's a cool like mechanism that you have iron. We talked a bit about iron leaching being reduced when you go from the oxidized rust colored iron to the gray kind of reduced iron. It actually becomes way more soluble, and then it can travel in a way that it couldn't before. And so then this mechanism of pollutification is that the iron over time is leached out of soils, and then it travels down in the soil to a point where it reaches some amount of oxygen, is reoxidized, and then it reforms the more solid phase iron 3, rust colored iron, and that creates sort of like a sort of natural iron pan that water can't percolate through. So I talked to Dave DeMore and some other people about this, and it seemed like there was a series of papers that explored this idea of pollutification in Southeast, and like I think it sort of implies that like the forest here will move towards being more wetland dominated over time. And I think it's like, my sense is that it's not like thought to be the dominant driver of, you know, where wetlands are and where they're not, and that the forest dynamics and development are a whole range of different reasons. I don't want to say that it's been discredited, like basically, but I don't think it's accepted as like that's the mechanism of wetland formation. But the reason that I think that's really interesting, or extra reason that I think that's really interesting as a Scot, is that in the UK, in Scotland, there's this sort of ongoing debate about whether the loss of our former rainforests is a natural process. And so there's reference to pollutification as like, oh, we're now in the last 1,000 years in Scotland has been wetter and cooler, and that's why we lost our rain. That's a big reason why we lost the rainforest, and we were always going to, and we shouldn't be trying to recreate the rainforest here, because it's naturally shifted to bogs because of the wet, cold conditions. And and I guess I've sort of been exploring that question a little bit, and I feel like the like vast cover of forests here is some indication that you can have very wet conditions and still have a lot of forest cover. So I would like to explore that in the UK, because I think it's feeding into the debate about, you know, if you feel like it's an entirely natural process, then you might not be as encouraged to take action to restore the woods. And I'm somewhat in partial towards the idea of having a more forested Scotland. So,
well, it is an interesting, because Scotland is similar latitude to mm-hmm. Southeast Alaska, mm-hmm. kind of covers roughly the same range of latitudes, I think, on the east side of a big ocean. So, you know, that catching all the rain off the moisture off the oceans there. relatively moderated, you know, oceanic kind of moderated climate. And it does, I mean, one thing that occurs to me is in Southeast Alaska, windthrow is and landslides are big forest disturbance mechanisms. And that, I would imagine, often goes deep enough to break up that pan, for example. And so if that's happening, you know, I don't know what kind of scale of time scales that that's it would be important on, but maybe it's happening enough that, because, you know, a system can have multiple stable equilibrium, where it's like, okay, this is a forest and stable dynamic. It's dynamic, you know. I like to describe the forest here as in a dynamic equilibrium. We're having windthrow all the time. There's landslides happening. You know, there's the rot of various sorts. But generally speaking, qualitatively, it looks pretty much the same. One spot of forest is going to be changing over time, you know. But this equilibrium.
If you want to use biogeochemical lingo, you could use steady state.
Okay, so it's in a steady state. Yeah. But the reason I sort of shy away from that is because it's not. That implies a steadiness that isn't present. Like it's always changing. Mm-hmm. You know, if I walk up a trail over my lifetime, last 20 or 30 years, like the trail moves because the river moves, the forest trees fall down but qualitatively it's still very similar, right? Where it's not gone from forest to bog. But bog may be another stable equilibrium, right? You don't have the disturbance. If you get that pollutification, then it's there and there's nothing to break that up. You don't have trees to fall over and, you know, maybe there they didn't have the same kind of species of trees and maybe they didn't fall over the same way. I don't know. But, you know, you're not having landslides in the same way. Like I could imagine, I don't really know, but I could imagine that there's, you know, two steady states essentially that are stable states. And one of them is a forested one and one of them is a bog one. And accidents of history or human intervention, as the case may be, may predispose a landscape to being one or the other. But either are supportable in that sort of a landscape. And, you know, I don't tend to think about which one should is a difficult question in that case. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I don't know what should be the case, but it does raise interesting questions for me. Like, yeah, like what could be the case, you know? And I don't know if that's true. Like maybe Scotland would have gone to that. Maybe that's a story that allows us to kind of be okay with what is. I don't know how that works out. You know, humans are really good at our stories and things for better and worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think the, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the, like asking for a deeper awareness of, I think one way to deepen people's awareness about natural history is to tell a more compelling story. And normally the more compelling story is the more accurate one because like it's so natural world is so like complex and interesting. And so I think like this idea of like the wild woodland of the United Kingdom or the British Isles, like that's for some people, that's where that's all it goes to, right? That's you can say it in a sentence. And I feel like there's got to be so much history, natural and human history, that's effectively overlooked because it's just sort of in the public conscience. It's just like, all right, we used to have woodlands, now we don't. That's it. But I think so I was just like, yeah, just wanted to agree with you on that last point you were making. And so then I think you're actually touching on something really interesting about that, like that trajectory of change. Like, do we see like a linear change in ecosystems that you sort of have a shift in vegetation towards this climax community, or do you have, I think the other view that is probably more like, yeah, more accepted now is what you're like, I think of what you were describing with the dynamic equilibrium of that you have, yeah, different stable states you have different stable states and the system can move between them, sometimes after a perturbation. But like maybe you're never really on a straight line headed in one direction ever, you know. I think that the way that you can think about it, that where you could actually go, you could still apply in either case, is just that evolutionary perspective for ecosystems, that they're always responding to change. And so, like, when we do see the same patterns, the same shifts over time, say, or space, then you do see, you do often see consistent patterns in their behavior, and it looks like it's achieving, oh, we've reached a climax community because we've headed down the same path. And this, in this region, this is the path that they head down, that the ecosystems head down. But I think that can be true at the same time as the bigger, the more encompassing framework is that, like, all ecosystems are dynamically responding to, in sort of an evolutionary other way, to different stressors or perturbations or just the conditions, just the climate, say, just as, you know, a relatively unchanging thing, say. So that I've actually really enjoyed getting into some of the literature on that recently, because it seems both here in Alaska, where you have an intact rainforest, and in a place like Scotland, where you have it almost completely removed, it's, I think, when you talk about conservation, when you talk about natural history, it's like, it's kind of important to know whether, to what, how true it is that, you know, you're going to arrive at a certain point after certain management intervention, or if we do see, you know, if you project out climate, and what if those projections become true, like, what is there like a foregone conclusion for what the ecosystems will turn into, I think just to say that it's I feel like those different steady states or different equilibrium conditions you were mentioning, I think that does square pretty well with, like, the kind of evolutionary perspective on ecosystems.
It's no end of complications in the end, I suppose, you know. Yeah, it's fascinating. We need to wrap up here kind of at the end of our time, but I know you're giving a talk here. As if you're listening to this on Sunday as it's airing on the radio, you're giving a talk Thursday, October 24th at the University of Alaska Southeast, part of the Natural History Seminar Series.
Yep.
And do you have I can't remember what the title is off the top of my head, but basically you'll be talking about some of this stuff you're working on.
Yeah, it's going to be climate connections in the temperate rainforest, and insights from soil, streams, and yellow cedar stands. So it is a little bit of my own research background, but bringing in a lot of other people's work to try to flesh that story out and see what. It's going to be like kind of exploring, like, what do climate interactions mean in the rainforest?
All right. And it sounds like, I mean, yeah, you're at the very beginning of this yellow cedar sort of based project. And sounds like you're interested in hearing from community members that might have questions or, you know, experiences with cedar and cedar stands. So that a good place to get in touch, or through the Science Center?
Yeah, I have an office, a desk, in the Science Center. So happy to chat to people if they want to drop by. Also invite anyone to come to the seminar. I'm really at the beginning of the Yellow Cedar Project, so would love to hear from anyone interested.
Well, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded and originally aired back in October of 2024. I was speaking with Gavin McNichol, who was in Sitka as part of a Scientist-in-Residence Fellowship at the Sitka Sound Science Center. He's an assistant professor at the University of Illinois and was doing some preliminary work here to begin a multi-year project looking at some of the impacts of cedar decline. I want to thank him again for taking some time to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there, especially as we're heading into this more fall-like season. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or you can hop on my website, sitkanature.org, and leave me a message there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCW, Sitka.